Welcome back to the show. I'm Maya Schwader. College sports are big business. In 2019, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, generated close to $1 billion off of men's basketball alone. But they've long faced scrutiny over the fact that the players get nothing. The association maintains that, well, their athletes are amateurs, and paying them would defeat the purpose. But now a crack has appeared in the NCAA's armor. In a 9-0 ruling, the Supreme Court said that student-athletes are allowed to receive limited education-related compensation, like laptops or taking paid internships or jobs. This case in question does not deal with whether student-athletes should be outright paid, but the implications of this decision could be wide-ranging. Later in the show, we'll speak with a former athletics director about how athletes and coaches will be taking in the news.
I'm Dara Kennedy. According to the fiscal year annual report by the NCAA, the total revenues among all Division I athletic departments in 2019 was $18.9 billion. Putting numbers into perspective, the NCAA has a $5,000 cap on the educational gifts and benefits that student athletes can receive. It seems broad in scope, but it is quite detailed. So to explain the depths of this long-running dispute, we turn to an expert, Andrew Zimbalist, an economist and Smith College professor, who was also cited throughout the Supreme Court case.
The Supreme Court was asked to review a case that was brought up in the Ninth Circuit in California. It was around the question of the caps on athlete compensation that the NCAA places. And the Supreme Court ruled to uphold the decision that was made both in the district court in California by Judge Wilkin and the appeals court in the Ninth Circuit, to uphold a ruling that said that the NCAA could not cap educational related benefits to athletes. This is not direct compensation to athletes, it's educationally tethered benefits. So a school could give an athlete a scholarship. We know about that already. That's been allowed since the 1950s. But a school could also say to an athlete, if you come to our school, we'll give you a scholarship to go to graduate school, also in addition to going to undergraduate school. Or they can say that we're going to give you a laptop or a desktop computer, or they're going to allow the athlete to have an internship over the summertime to work with professors. So this allows schools now to compete with each other, to go to their high school prospects and offer them more in the form of benefits, not in compensation. There still can't be salary, because if there's salary, then the athletes become employees of the university rather than having an educational relationship with the university. So that's basically what the ruling said yesterday. So historically, it's been the case that there are 351 schools in Division I, and virtually all of those schools in one way or another are trying to emulate the top schools. They're trying to catch the top schools, and they're going to find it increasingly difficult or impossible to do so now. So we'll see a further division in the NCAA, I believe.
A basic question would be, why would the NCAA want to limit those educational benefits anyway?
Well, it's always difficult to understand what the motivations are of the NCAA, and moreover, the motivations seem to change all the time. But one of the things that the NCAA has bought into is this notion that college sports is amateur sports, and by keeping them as amateur sports, you're preserving the commitment to the primacy of education. That sports is just an extracurricular activity. The real reason why these students are at school is to get an education. And as long as we make sure that they remain amateur and don't get paid for anything, then we can assure that they're going to get a good education. And that's a bunch of malarkey. It's self-interested, duplistic nonsense. If they want to assure that students are getting education, what they should do is make sure that schools don't engage in academic fraud. And they don't do that. The NCAA, when they've had a chance to go after schools for committing academic fraud, they say, no, it's not our business to do that. There's a more complicated relationship there.
Justice Gorsuch said in his opinion yesterday, or rather Brett Kavanaugh, this is illegal. This, the way that the NCAA operates would not be legal in any other business in America. Right. In that ruling yesterday, when I went back to look at it, you cited going back to the 1850s, I believe, with, was it Harvard and Yale, in the very first intercollegiate sporting event. And that was quoted in the Supreme Court decision.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I guess it's a case of the blind leading the blind. I was happy to be quoted. It was, there was the first intercollegiate contest was in the 1850s at Lake Winnipesaukee. It was a crew match or a rowing match between Ivy League schools. And oddly enough, the real reason for it was that there was a new railroad that had opened up, and they were trying to encourage people from New York and Boston to use their railroad service. And so they brought the athletes up, they paid the athletes to have this meet. And that was the initial beginning.
I think what I just heard you say is that a railroad executive sponsored a rowing match back in 1852 between Harvard and Yale. Fast forward, and you're even quoted again, this Princeton and Yale competition was bringing in $25,000 in what they called gate revenues, and we now to know the box office. $25,000 in the 1800s was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. You know, what schools were facing in the last half of the 19th century was that the Congress had passed something called the Morrill Act in 1861, primarily to teach engineering and agronomy skills. But as these colleges came online, University of Michigan, University of Wisconsin, and on and on and on, all of these colleges were popping up, but students weren't popping up because people who went to college in the 1860s and 70s were the upper crust. They're very high income individuals. So the demand for going to college was much lower than the supply of college places available. So colleges needed to compete with each other and needed to advertise and promote themselves in order to draw the students. And college presidents simply decided that the best way to do this was through developing athletic teams.
The difference is back then, some of the athletes I read in the opinion actually were offered trips to Cuba and lavish prizes, all
right.
Expenses paid vacations.
Right. Yeah, well, it's just grown from there. That's the unholy beginnings of it all. One very large event, a very important event, was the last time the Supreme Court made a ruling about college sports was in 1984. The top football schools in the country were suing the NCAA because the NCAA controlled the national television contracts and distributed the money equally to schools, whether they were the top schools or the bottom schools in college football. So this decision yesterday, now almost 40 years later, is only the second time the Supreme Court has inserted itself into the organization of college sports.
You're listening to And Another Thing. We are speaking with Andrew Zimbalist, economist and Smith College professor, on the long-running NCAA antitrust case initiated by a group of former student athletes. There's billions of dollars in revenue coming. And with that being said, there's the bills that are coming along in July would be the ones that are focused on direct compensation, right?
Well, that's also a little bit more complicated than that. You're referring to the NIL or name, image, and likeness legislation that's been passed at many states. And in about six of those states, the legislation is supposed to take effect on July 1st. And so what this legislation will enable the schools to do is to allow their athletes to make deals with third parties, not with the schools themselves. The schools won't be the employer of the athlete, the employee. No, that relationship is not allowed by NIL or publicity rights income. But it does allow the students to go to a Nike, or it's Nike to go to the students, or for the students to become influencers on social media and receive income for that activity. As long as it's a third party, then it doesn't disrupt the educator-educatee relationship between the university and the student athlete. So that's what the NIL bills presumably will allow. It's going to be quite chaotic because only six states will begin to allow that in July. The NCAA is working on separate legislation, and the U.S. Congress, mostly through the Commerce Committee, but also through some other committees in the Senate, are also working on legislation. So there's a lot of stuff to get worked out now, and each of these bills, each of these initiatives have a slew of complicating factors that have to be handled. So one of the things we know for sure is that this is a period of tumult. I guess it's always been a period of tumult in college sports, but it's even going to be more tumultuous now than ever before. And there's going to be some very, very substantial changes in this animal that we call college sports as we know it.
When we bring it back to the Sean Austin ruling, which was the ruling that came down yesterday, the name of the case that came down yesterday, what does it mean for the group of former athletes that initiated this case?
Just about nothing, unless they derive vicarious pleasure from changing the sport that they feel was exploiting them. Those athletes are done with college sports. What this does, even though it was brought by former college athletes, this opens up the possibility for future college athletes to get enhanced benefits. There have been many econometric studies that try to link athletic success to donations to the school and to try to link it to the quality of the student body, the quality of the applicants. The findings are not robust statistically. They tend to be all over the map. So the relationships are not as strong and clear as college presidents and college boards of trustees would like to believe. But nonetheless, it's part of the culture right now that says that this stuff for these top schools, they believe that their DNA requires them to be successful athletically, and hence they're pursuing that.
And is it just Division I?
Yes, it's just Division I. But Division I is the commercialized division, and it's where colleges have the motivation to try to attract high school players and high school students to help them become more competitive as colleges, and so it's only in Division I that you see full ride scholarships for the student athletes. And it's only in Division I, and really only in the very top of Division I, that schools will have a motivation to engage in this new ability that the Supreme Court gave them yesterday, which is to offer educationally tethered benefits in an unlimited or uncapped fashion.
As you mentioned, this is not a direct compensation ruling. Why do you think so many people celebrated yesterday when the ruling came down?
Yeah, so I think that the story here that is perhaps most significant is that this is building the momentum that has been growing for some time, but really accelerated momentum since roughly 2010 through a variety of antitrust cases and through some legislative initiatives. It's accelerating the momentum to say that the existing model of college sports is hypocritical and duplicative and fraudulent, and that it doesn't make sense for a bunch of white male coaches to be getting paid $5 million up to $10 million a year on the backs of student athletes, large shares of them, over 50% of the student athletes in Division I men's basketball, over 50% are black. And something like 48.5% in football are black. So you have predominantly white male coaches making millions and millions of dollars off of the labor of and very grueling and dangerous labor of lower income and black income and black student athletes. And it's morally repugnant. So I think a lot of people want to see the system changed. There are a variety of ways that the reform can go. But it's exciting to see the Supreme Court, particularly a Supreme Court that's really loaded with conservative judges, to see a Supreme Court vote 9-0 and reprimand the NCAA for maintaining a morally difficult, morally problematic system.
Sean Austin, for whom the case is named, is a former running back for West Virginia and filed the suit in 2014. That was sports economist and professor from Smith College, Andrew Zimbalist.
Coming up, we'll talk to a former Division I athletics director about what the NCAA needs to do to avoid self-destruction. And another thing, we'll be right back.
For a check of the day's business news, join us this evening at 6:30 for Marketplace on NEPM and on your smart speaker. And another thing on NEPM is funded by you and ServiceNet, providing mental health and human services and welcoming therapists seeking independence and flexibility. ServiceNet.org/jobs. Cloudy skies tonight with showers wrapping up and low temperatures near 50. The sun returns for Wednesday, highs in the upper 70s. You're listening to New England Public Media.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Maya Schwader. While this ruling only has a narrow effect for now, there is hope among advocates that this could force the NCAA to stop hiding their athletes behind the label amateur. We spoke with Dr. Donna Lopiano. Currently, she's a sports consultant in Connecticut, but before that, she had a storied softball career and was a Division I athletic director at the University of Texas. She told us that the NCAA's definition of who or what an amateur is was never very clear to begin with.
I think what was important about the decision was the recognition that the NCAA's definition of amateur status was a moving target. It changed according to the whims of the NCAA, and it was meant to control compensation to athletes. And that's been clear for many years as institutions became increasingly rich with television money, that the gap between the money they were putting in the back pockets of coaches and building these lavish facilities and how they were treating athletes, that gap was getting huge. I think that has precipitated what we see today. I'm not quite worried about adjustment to that because I think athletes will benefit from increased resources that have never been applied to their needs, especially with regard to the need for a medical trust fund. The NCAA has $1 billion set aside just for concussion treatments 20 or 30 years after they leave the NFL. And, that's for 5,000, 10,000 NFL players ever. And we go through 30,000 football players a year in college. And who's going to take care of them when dementia or Parkinson's or any of these after effects of repetitive hits to the head become apparent? And nobody's ever taken any part of that television revenue money and set it aside to deal with the future we know is going to happen to so many of these college athletes. So, if I were an athletic director, am I worried about the money part of it? I think it's a good worry because now people are going to have to pay reasonable salaries to coaches and not seven figures. This is not right, what's going on right now, and the ship has got to be right. It will be troublesome, yes, but I'm not sweating it as much as I'm applauding the fact that finally the time has come for intercollegiate athletics reform.
One of the big arguments that the NCAA made was they want to preserve the spirit of amateurism. They want students to be doing this for the love of the game, not for the compensation or the perks. Do you imagine that this decision, possibly opening the door for compensation, might change players' motivations?
Not yet. And the reason why I say that is because this is a very narrow decision. They only affirmed a decision of a previous court to allow institutions to determine legitimate educational expenses beyond an artificial limit set by the NCAA. And so it's opened an educational expenses door, not a salary door. That may come in subsequent court cases now that this NCAA amateur status dies, has been, you know, defeated or blown up. But right now, it's a matter of looking at educational expenses. And I think whatever we can spend on the educational expenses of athletes, and like I said, the after effects of injury on athletes, that should be a first call on all resources.
One of the predictions coming out of this is that this might be the end of the NCAA as we know it. You spoke about needing to right the ship. Do you imagine that the NCAA will be able to right the ship, or is this the end of the NCAA as we know it?
I think you'll see an immediate change in the NCAA. I think that the if there's no change, they deserve the destruction. You're looking right now at NCAA leadership that has failed. You have college presidents as members of the board of governors who have given free range, you know, to Mark Emmert, which, you know, the president of the NCAA, and it's failed policy. They've refused to appoint an independent board of directors that would better balance the institutional interest and the student interest. Right now, the NCAA is a trade association for athletic directors and college coaches who are making big money, and institutions who are making big money and getting brand advantages from winning teams. And the kids are last persons on the totem pole. And that's going to change. If it results in the demise of the NCAA, so be it. But I think it's a picture right there. We've been through this before in open amateur sport, in Olympic sports, and we opened up the marketplace for athletes to, you know, earn their own money and to operate in a free marketplace in the mid-1970s with the Amateur Sport Act. So what it says to me right now is it would be helpful for Congress to jump in and create a collegiate sports act. Something the equivalent of what was done in the 70s to right the ship and better balance the athlete and institutional interests in college sport. Now, it's going to be interesting to see if Congress is so far apart that it can't even do a simple deal. But that would be helpful. And we know that Congress can do this. Congress can step in and create a mechanism for positive change. But is Congress just as inept as the NCAA Board of Governors is the question.
Dr. Donna Lopiano is a former Division I athletics director.
The NCAA released a statement following the ruling saying that the Supreme Court decision, quote, reaffirms the NCAA's authority to adopt reasonable rules.
The statement continues saying that the NCAA remains free to articulate what are and are not truly educational benefits.
Thanks to our guests for joining us today. We welcome your comments. Call us, 800-639-9120. I'm Dara Kennedy. Thank you for listening.
You can follow us on social media. We are at Hello and Another, or email us at andanotherthing@nepm.org. I'm Maya Schwader. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.